Hey everybody, it's Sean Mills with HackMyHomestead.com and welcome to the Hack My Homestead podcast. Today is Saturday, September 30th, 2023, and today we're going to talk about the seven layers of a forest. So we're continuing our permaculture series, and what we're talking about here is what are the different layers of a forest and how can we recreate them in a food forest? So starting at the top and working our way down, we've got the canopy. The canopy are the tall trees in the forest. They're typically 30 foot tall or taller. They are useful for timber. They're useful for big mast trees like oak and hickory. In the event of a food forest, they could be things like, I forgot the name, pecan. I don't know why I just... My mind went blank there. I could see the nut, but I couldn't think of what it was. But pecans or black walnuts, most of your large nut variety trees would fit into the canopy. Now, the thing to remember about canopy is that it's really just referring to the top layer of the forest. And that's important because when we're building a food forest, our canopy might be 10 feet off the ground, just depending on what kind of area we're working in. If I'm building a backyard, food forest, I might have a quote unquote canopy at a very low layer, or I might just skip the canopy altogether. And I might start with the next category, which is called sub-canopy. Now your sub-canopy is going to be in the 10 to 30 foot tall range normally. And a lot of times these are your fruit trees, these are nitrogen fixers, things like that. So your apple trees, your pear trees, your plum trees, things like that are going to fall into the sub-canopy layer. And the way that these two layers work together, obviously the canopy is the large overstory tree, but outside of rainforest, it typically doesn't block out all light. So your sub-canopy collects some of that light that's kind of filtered through into the lower levels, and it's also very good at helping to collect rainwater. And so when we think about how all these different systems work together in a healthy food forest where all layers are represented, you almost won't be able to see dirt or soil. You won't be able to see the actual ground. And that's helpful because in the event that there's a heavy rainstorm, we aren't getting a lot of erosion. We aren't getting these water droplets that are falling from the heavens and slamming into the ground and creating issues. You know, if you've ever gone out and walked around like a gravel driveway after a big rainstorm and looked at the puddles, you know, and you're already starting to see some suspended clay at the top, a little bit of organic matter and stuff like that. All of that came from other areas and just filled in because it was subjected to that heavy rainfall. And so one of the things that these different layers do is to help protect the soil and slow down that water. You've heard of a drip line on a tree. So the tree is going to collect that rainfall, and then it's going to slowly drip from the leaves down into the root structure of that tree. And that's another thing that we need to be thinking about is we want to make sure that there's enough room for the roots to spread out and do their work when we're designing a food forest. So then we go down another layer to what's called the shrub layer. And so the shrub layer is going to be things under 10 foot tall. They could be things like dwarf fruit trees, but mostly they're going to be, you know, shrubs and bushes. They're going to be berries. They're going to be medicinal. They're going to be, you know, woody herbs and things like that. The top three layers, the canopy, the sub-canopy, and the shrub layer, are typically represented by their woody mass staying behind. So in the event that you don't have an evergreen tree, those trees and shrubs are going to lose their leaves in the winter, but the woody structure is going to remain, okay? When we go down to the next layer, which is the herbaceous layer and below typically loses that woody mass and dies all the way back to the ground and then comes back the following year, whether through seeding or whether through, you know, storing its energy in a bulb and coming back the following year. But the layers below the shrub layer typically die all the way back, whereas the layers, canopy, subcanopy, and shrub, those woody structures remain year over year. Now, if we think about what happens when we have this, these canopy or subcanopy trees, which have tree trunks, one of the things that happens is that you'll have vines that crawl up those trees. And so that's another layer called the vining layer. And I know a lot of people number these layers, and a lot of times the vining layer is like layer 6 or layer 7, but I like thinking about it from the top down. And so if my eyes are starting at the top, I'm going to see the canopy. And then as I move my eye level down, I'll see the subcanopy. Then I'll see the shrub layer. And then depending on what I've got growing in there, maybe even all the way up to the canopy level, I'm going to see those climbers or that vining layer. Okay. And so vining, plant is one that's going to use another plant's structure for support. Okay. So if we think about the old traditional Indian Three Sisters garden, right? The beans would climb the stalks of the corn. And so in that scenario, the corn was acting as the canopy and the bean was acting as the vining layer. Okay. So like I said, below, so you've got your canopy, you've got your subcanopy, you've got your shrub layer, and you've got your vining layer, which can exist in all three of those elevations. And then as we continue to move down again, this will be your first layer below the shrub layer, excluding the vining layer, and that's the herbaceous layer. So no woody stem there. These are where your vegetables are typically going to be growing. You're going to have your ornamentals here. You're going to have your insectiary plants here, herbs. You're going to have a lot of support species, dynamic accumulators, things like that. Those things are a lot of times are going to live in this herbaceous layer. And you know, herbaceous layer can get pretty tall, but they're separated from the shrub layer by the fact that they die back and their woody structure does not remain. As a matter of fact, you can plant herbaceous layer plants that'll get taller than your shrub layer plants, but they will die back to the ground at the end of the year. So your next one as you're going from top to bottom is called your ground cover layer or your creeper layer, okay? And so these are plants that typically grow on the ground, crawl across the ground, or very low to the ground. They're typically very shade tolerant, right? Because they're meant to be at the bottom of the structure that has canopy and subcanopy and vining and shrub and herbaceous layer above it. And they're going to fill in between your herbaceous layer plants. So your mints, you know, strawberry is a great example of this. You've got herbs like oregano, creeping thyme, things like that. They're going to grow, you know, within an inch or two of the ground, but they're going to grow out and cover and fill in those spaces in between your herbaceous layer plants. And so then your next layer is actually below the ground, okay? And so this is your root area, your underground area. And most of these plants in the root zone will probably actually have a portion of their plant above the root zone, taking part of the herbaceous or ground cover layer as well. And so when we think about things like onions, Jerusalem artichoke, potatoes, you know, medicinals like ginseng or ginger, all of these grow below the ground, or their yield is below the ground. Another one would be like a sweet potato here's the funny thing about a sweet potato. So a sweet potato, the potato part's going to be your root crop. And if you let the vine crawl across the ground, that's going to be ground cover. But you could actually train that up into the vine layer. Now, I don't think that a sweet potato vine would particularly love being trained up a tree, and it would be work. But it could actually take that place if you had other ground covers that you didn't want the sweet potato vines to cover up. So just something to think about there. So if we're thinking about how to actually implement these different layers. Oh, you know what? I skipped one. I didn't skip one, but there's another that should be mentioned, and that's your fungal layer. Okay, so in the root layer, you're going to have your mycorrhizal fungi, or in the event that you actually introduce deadwood or let deadfall stay in the forest, you'll have mycorrhizal inoculation of those of that canopy and subcanopy detritus, so to speak, and that will inoculate a couple of these different layers. And then when that fungi fruits and you actually get the mushroom, then that's going to be in the herbaceous and the ground cover layer. So that's one of those that it doesn't have its own layer typically when we're talking about the different layers of the forest, but it can kind of live in a couple of the different ones, and not can, it has to live in a couple of different ones. You absolutely need to be inoculating your food forest with mycorrhizal beneficial fungi. Even if you don't like mushrooms, for the beneficial effects that it will have on the soil biology and the soil structure. And so, for example, in my household, I'm the only one that really likes mushrooms. I think occasionally my kids will eat them. I don't really pay attention to that anymore. My wife can't stand it. She'll try them every now and again to just make sure she still doesn't like them. But it's a texture thing for her. So, but that being said, as we're establishing food forest, I'm inoculating, even if I'm just bringing things like leaf litter from the deep forest in and tossing it in with the compost that's then later spread, we're doing things like that just to make sure that we get that mycorrhizal fungi layer established. Back when we were planting, raised beds with chicken runs around them on this property, I'd go into the woods and I'd grab some leaf litter and I'd toss it into those raised beds as we were building them up and filling them with soil, because I wanted that mycorrhizal fungi to be in there helping out. So if we think about building an actual food forest from scratch, we're planting all the layers, we're establishing everything at one time. We could go in, and what we don't want to do is we don't want any of these layers to be a monoculture, okay? And so I've heard people like Jack Spierko and Jeff Lawton, say that you want a ratio of support species to productive species of between 3 and 7, or maybe even up to 10 to 1, depending on how healthy the soil is that you're starting with. And what we're talking about there is that, like, at the canopy layer, you could have a pear tree, right? But you don't want all pear trees. You could also mix in, for example, a black locust. So a black locust is going to be a nitrogen-fixing plant. It can also be used for fence poles and things like that. So it's got multiple yields. If you're going to use black locust and pear trees together, you might want to plant 4 or 5 black locusts for every pear tree. Early on in establishment, you might want to plant 10 to 1, knowing that you're going to be coming back and selectively extracting some of that black locust lumber to clear the canopy so that your pears and your mature black locust can grow out into there. But then if you go to the subcanopy layer, you might be planting things like mulberry. You might be planting things like wild lilac. You might be actually planting what could be a canopy tree and then just annually pruning it back down so that it maintains that lower canopy within the system. So you could put an apple tree into the subcanopy and just prune it down. Your shrub layer, you might have things like autumn olive and raspberry and hazelnut, okay? And then you might have herb. The herb layer could be planted intermixed with asparagus and rosemary and dill, nasturtium, some annual plants in there like tomatoes and things like that. On your ground cover, maybe you've got some red and white clover mixed in with some spearmint, some oregano, some creeping thyme. You might even have some ivies and things like that, because one of the things that I learned from Billy Bond is when we're planting these systems, we should also keep the visual aspect and the beauty of the system in mind. Not everything has to have a function. You know, some things function can literally be, I want it to look pretty. Okay. And this is, I think as a guy, we typically skip over this, and maybe I'm generalizing, but that's okay. I'll do it. But I think a lot of times we kind of skip over the beauty of the systems. We don't think about that as much as we probably should. Or we actively ignore trying to design for beauty. And so, you know, something to think about with these systems is every one of these layers can be a productive plant, and it can also be pretty. Because look, if a flower grows, what's that going to do? Well, it's going to bring pollinators in. Okay, and so we can plant things that literally have no purpose other than to look pretty, to bloom at a certain point of the year, and or to bring in pollinators to provide food for the pollinators and things like that. Then your climbing layer, you know, you could put things like gooseberry. You could plant annual climbers like squashes that you train up, or cucumbers that you train up. You know, they could live in this climbing or vining layer. You can inoculate all of the area with, you know, oyster mushroom mycelium, and you know, bury some logs halfway, so that your ground layer eventually at certain times of the year when the moisture is correct will also produce mushrooms at the ground level. And then, you know, on your root layer, you could plant things like daikon radish and garlic. And, you know, daikon radish can be something that you don't even harvest. You just let grow. It helps break the soil up, and then it composts in its own hole and creates food for the soil biology, and you know, helps the soil become better structured. And then just have your garlic and maybe some, you know, maybe you've got some standard bulb garlic, and then you've also got some elephant garlic there, which I think elephant garlic typically or technically is an onion. It just tastes like garlic. So. But you know, different things from the allium family you could plant as those root crops. And so if you were thoughtful about this, even if you had a relatively small area, you could plant to take advantage of all these different layers vertically, and then horizontally you can intermix useful plants, pioneer plants, support species, productive plants. And then you can also kind of spread the harvest out. So you can plant things that provide a yield in March, and different things that provide a yield in April and May and June, and then have a big flush in July and August and September. But then also have things maybe on your annual planting you're actually replacing. So you're taking things out and say, you know, you're harvesting in, say, July and planting a fall crop in that area that maybe takes up a different layer. And now you're getting, you know, yields into October and maybe even November. And most of these systems, you know, your December, January, February, you're just not going to get much. But that doesn't mean that you can't go in and manage those systems, clear out deadfall, prune, and, you know, remove either firewood trees or post trees in the winter. So there's always something that can be done in the gardens, even when you're not harvesting an actual thing you're putting in your mouth. You can harvest other things that can be useful for your homestead. So I think I'll wrap it up there today with the seven layers of a forest and how we can recreate them into in a food forest. If you guys have questions or comments or concerns, you can email me at Sean, S-H-A-W-N, at hackmyhomestead.com. I'll give you a quick Kickstarter update here at the end. Editing has taken much longer than we thought. Part of that was because we've never produced a full-length movie before. Trying to export the information in a manner that was usable by the audio editor took about a week and multiple tries going back and forth. And then even when we got the final thing submitted, there were missing files, and it was a lot more detailed than we knew going in. So even a month ago when I was saying, you know, I think we'll have everything done by the end of September, because, you know, once we have all the editing, the video editing done, we just send that over to the audio editor and he takes a week or so, and then we've got a final. That, you know, from the time we stopped filming until the time we actually got that to him 100% complete was probably between 3 and 4 weeks. And so where, you know, I was thinking best case scenario, we get everything done at the end of, or, you know, third week of September, realistically, is when I expected people to be receiving things. You know, we're realistically now probably looking at early October. So I'm recording this on the last day of September. He has everything. He's verified that he's received everything, and everything has the right tags and all of that type of stuff on there. And he's given us a couple ideas on some things that we can do for B-roll and overlays. And so we're going to be taking care of that while he is doing the audio editing so that it doesn't add any more time. But one of the things we are doing is today, on the last day of September, we are actually going to post a raw edit version on YouTube and send that out to the backers. It won't be the final version, but I feel really, really bad about not having this thing done when we said we were going to. And I think everyone that I've talked to understands that, hey, you're doing something you've never done before. You know, you didn't really know what it was going to take. And we understand that. And we're looking forward to a good product and those type of things. And I appreciate that, because I really kind of been beating myself up a little bit about not doing what I said I was going to do. We've done everything in our power, but there were just some things that we didn't know about. So, anyways, still, you know, gonna get a raw edit of the movie with probably not great sound out today. And, I've already sent out the, thanks rewards. I will get the, frequently asked questions document out today. And then as soon as we have a final movie, we'll be posting that, sending out the streaming codes, and loading all of those up on the USBs and getting those in the mail. The other thing was that all of the layers of, of shipping movies out or shipping anything out, even folks that are getting just a T-shirt, they're also getting a thumb drive. And so I can't even send them their T-shirt until, of course, I have the thumb drive. So that is just, you know, we learned a lot. I'll say that. I think going forward, if we do any more Kickstarter movies, we will do the content and then we will look for funding to fund the editing and distribution. And, and now we know how to get that done and how to get that out and how to get it back and put back together. So starting to lose my voice a little bit. So I'm going to cut it out there for the day. Thanks everyone for joining me, and we'll talk to you next time.